listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Good morning, everyone. You're on Reality Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney Hyde, and we've got our favourite professor gardening guru, Dr. Professor Wally Richards. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning. Good morning.
I can see you, and listeners can't. You look like you're rugged up.
Well, I've been up for several hours, but...
No, but you look like you're rugged up for the cold.
Oh, I've still got my jammies on.
Are you a nighttime gardener?
Modern style pajamas, yep. Beanie.
You look like you go to... Do you wear a beanie in bed?
Yes, I do, because... my head gets cold unless it's under the blankets. Do you wear your beanie in bed?
No.
Why not? A lot of your body temperature goes out through your head. You know that, don't you?
Yeah, and my room goes down to like 4 degrees, 5 degrees at night.
Right.
So it's cold, but I haven't had that problem, but I might try it tonight because it's getting cold down here at Queenstown Way. It's getting snow. Skiers are happy. Interesting, a beanie. I go to a friend's place for a spa. No, a sauna. He's got a wood-fired sauna.
Right.
And I bought for him a felt sauna hat and one for me. And it's extraordinary. It's a hoot because you look so silly. It's like an elf's hat. You put the sauna hat on your head made out of felt and you sit there in the sauna and you can last like, say if you were doing half an hour and you had to get out, you can do like 45 minutes because it keeps your head cool and it's a reverse effect.
Okay.
And so instead of wanting to get out with your head cool, you're sitting there and you just sweat a lot more. It's actually quite delightful. I'm a big fan now of wearing a stupid, funny, laughing sauna hat in a sauna.
Okay. And I presume where you are, you've got snow on the ground and after being in for 45 minutes, you rush out naked and roll around in the snow, and then you take some branches off the tree and you whack each other with branches like they do in Scandinavian countries. You don't
three
do that?
Three bits of that are wrong. One is we're not naked, right?
Oh.
We're two guys. We're not going to get into a confined space naked.
I heard it's okay as long as you've got a bottle of beer in your hand.
Nope.
For two guys to be in the spa,
you need a weapon. No. Second, snow's not on the ground yet, so we jump into the lake, into a pond. And I have to say, it hits you so hard, you sometimes think I'm not coming up. And we don't do the hitting bit. So apart from that, you're right.
It's a big boost on the heart. I have angina and cold, like going from the hot into a cold outside or whatever. I can get the the feeling across the chin, et cetera.
So we've done that for years, and I have to say of late, I have just had a cold shower rather than jump into the pond because I did last. It hadn't been cold for a while, and then the cold hit, and I got such a shock. I thought, jeepers, I'm not sure I'm going to come up. But anyway, I'm still here. Now, we've got to get into it, but can I tell you how much I love my daughter's hens?
Right.
I've gone from being terrified to them to actually enjoying them immensely. I never knew hens were such fun.
Mm.
So we've got the 20-odd laying hens, and they're laying furiously, and I enjoy them immensely. And whenever I come around, they're always very curious what I'm up to. And so they've become quite a fun pet. And then we've got these little ones that are probably 3 or 4 weeks old. I'm still keeping them inside, but I let them out during the day. And they've actually become quite good company. I can have quite a decent conversation with a chicken.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, yeah. And if you got one in, under your arm and you know the crop on top of their head,
yeah,
you just stroke that gently. They love it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And I love getting them things like you suggested, like dog roll, and you feed them dog roll and they love you forever.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They love that
protein,
dog roll.
Meat.
Mm. Yeah. And I throw them a bone from a leg of lamb and they love that. And what's your view, Wally? I go into farmlands and they say, oh, you got to have layer feed. You know, they've got to have lots of this layer feed. And I nod my head and buy a lot. And then I think, is this true? What's the story with layer feed?
Well, there's different foods. Like, it's grains and stuff that you're getting them. My pick is, I think it's called chicken chow or something. It's got muesli in it, right?
Yeah.
So it's a mix of grains and the pellets. Yeah. And it's soaked in muesli. I give that to my chickens at nighttime for the afternoon nighttime feed, right? In the morning, along with also wheat, I always give them a scoop of wheat as well. And then in the morning, I've just got the ordinary mix, which has not got the molasses in it, right? So molasses at nighttime because that's carbohydrates, more energy, and then during the day, I will throw them grass, old veggies that have gone to seed, and so forth. You know, or leaves of silver beet.
They love.
They get the greens during the day, and any kitchen scraps too.
Yeah.
And midday meal, more or less.
When I turn up with the silver beet, they go absolutely nuts for that greens. Okay, Wally, we're going to be talking pruning and we're going to be talking soil pathogens. Are you up for that?
Yep.
I've never understood pruning, so tell me about that.
Pruning, right. Mm. Well, pruning is an interesting thing in so much as in nature, nobody comes along and prunes anything, right? The only pruners we find in nature is the wind, which damages and breaks off branches, or alternately, maybe if you've got a pet giraffe.
Oh, a giraffe, along
and nibbles on the top of the tree and so forth and does a bit of pruning for you. Why we prune? You can increase your fruit by diligently pruning. The problem is if you cut the end off a branch, it will then encourage dormant buds or branches to then come out of what hasn't been cut off, right? So sometimes at this time of the year when you've got trees available for sale, some of them are what we call a rod. Now, it's just a stick that goes straight up, about a metre and a half tall, right? Mm-hmm. That's a rod. Now, it's grafted onto rootstock, and it will be like an apple or peach or whatever. Now, because it's straight up and down, the first thing you do after you plant it is you lob off the top couple of inches of it, right? That encourages the side branching.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Right?
Now, in a developed tree, what can happen if you start lobbing, like I've got this guy just recently, he said, oh, my such and such a tree is getting too tall. Can I cut the branches and reduce its height? And I said, yeah, by all means. Problem is, if you reduce the height by cutting an upgrowing branch, you will then encourage a lot of side branches, which will end up being taller than the branch you started cutting the end of. And as I was writing this, I thought to myself, but there is a way to do it, which I explained to him in the email. I said, so when those side branches come, you remove them but leave a little bit because of the fruiting aspect. The key to it is you don't want your tree to get too dense. So the first thing in pruning a rose or a tree, you're going to look for the dead branches, you're going to look for the diseased branches, and you remove them back off from where they came from. And that's important to always remove back from whence they came.
Yeah.
Then, depending upon what you want to do with it, like for instance with a bush rose, they say you prune back on to about the second or third outgoing bud, right? And you can see the little buds on the canes, right? So you would lob right back to that. So you've got then those ones which will grow outwards to make what we call the wine glass effect, right?
Yeah.
Hollow in the middle and all your ice branches coming off, going out and producing the flowers. If you prune back in a rose to, say, the sixth or seventh outgoing bud, you're going to get a much denser and a bigger bush flowering, right, and a lot taller as well. If you wanted to really have some nice blooms but not a lot of blooms, of course, you start to remove those buds or blooms as they start to form. So you just end up with whatever you want. You can basically do designer work on a tree like espalier, for instance. Here you go. You've got your tree planted in the ground. It's a rod. You cut the top. And then when you get some side branches happening, you train them along the wires,
mm-hmm.
right? And you remove the ones you don't want. And then you let those ones produce small outgoing branches to produce the buds and fruit, et cetera, et cetera. Diligently pruning. The key with a lot of people with citrus trees, of course, is they tend to treat them like they're a hedge. And they chop all the ends off, and the tree gets so dense it's full of disease and full of pests. So once again, they should remove back some branches from whence they come to take them off the trunk. Or in the case of a tree that's a bit thin, you lob off the end off a branch, let some branches grow, and remove some and keep some. There are more sophisticated ways that can be done in pruning where after, like in the summertime, there's a summer pruning, which basically means that you've set some fruit, right, but the branch keeps growing outwards. So you cut the branch off so all the goodness goes into the fruit rather than to the new branch that's growing or continues to grow outwards. But it's just common sense. The key is don't do too much pruning if you don't know what you're doing, because you're likely to remove all your fruiting buds and you won't have any fruit to another season or so.
Well, it seems to a beginner gardener like me, this pruning seems quite a tough business. I remember my mum with her roses spending a great deal of time reading and debating about how to prune a rose to best effect. And the theory and the methods of doing that seemed quite complicated to me.
I'll tell you an interesting story I heard, and I presume it's true. In England, in one of the botanical gardens where they had heaps of rose beds, right? They invited two Rose Society clubs to come, and they were given a beard each for their members to prune, right, at the middle of winter. So they came along individually, so they didn't see each other, and they had their beard, and the two or three members went through and pruned the roses. Then they said to the city council bloke, he said, "Now, that's your beard there." He said, "Righty-o, gets the chainsaw out." No problems at all, right? Okay. So later on, in spring, summertime, when the plants, the roses are in flower, etc., once again, Rose Society members were invited to come along and inspect the three gardens to see which one they considered was the best. Guess who won? The chainsaw.
No.
Yep.
And why do you think that was?
I don't know. But that's the way the story goes. Maybe
it takes a lot of – so you shouldn't put a lot of pressure on yourself when you come to pruning.
No.
People tell me –
intimidated.
My mother was the biggest problem of the year.
The only pruning you don't do is 1 inch out of the ground.
Yes. That's not good. When you prune, do you cut at right angles or do you cut at an angle?
Now, the idea of your cut is not to allow water to settle on the cut. Right. So if it's at an angle, it means the water will shear off.
Got it. Okay. So you cut the water doesn't sit on it.
Yeah. If the water sits there, that could cause a rot.
Hmm. And what sort of things need pruning? All fruit trees, all roses? Anything else?
Once again, like in nature, nobody comes and prunes.
No.
So when you hearken back to that, things just do as they want to do type of thing. We tend to, like in nature, nobody comes and weeds, right?
Mm.
So you go into the bush and you see whatever's on the ground growing, the weeds or whatever, if they are able to grow, because in nature, plants tend to make it difficult for other plants to establish underneath them as competition. And so you don't get a lot of weeding. But we, of course, will go and weed and we'll plant in uniform lines, etc. And that in itself is a disadvantage because, for instance, you've got a paddock full of cabbages, right? Mr. White Butterfly comes along and says, "Oh, my God, look at that," you know, and then he goes laying eggs all over the place, right? Now, in nature, one cabbage might be every 10 metres or so, and amongst all other plants.
Yes.
So Mr. White Butterfly, he has to really go looking for a cabbage to find.
He's got
to
work.
Yeah. And so in nature, because of the complexity of many plants growing and not just a multicultural whatever, a lot of plants don't have a problem.
Mm. What time of year do you prune?
The worst time to prune, particularly with grapevines, is in the spring when the sap is rising. Because if you cut a branch of a grapevine in the spring when it's starting to move and the leaves are starting to come and so forth, you think you actually turned the bloody hose on the tap.
Wow.
Because it'll be all this water coming out through the cut and so forth.
So the sap rising is when you've gone through winter, they've lost all their leaves, they're dormant, spring's there, suddenly the plant is fired up and it's going to grow fresh leaves and the sap is rising to feed these leaves because it's warm, and if you cut it, it all just runs out uselessly onto the ground.
Yeah, you get all this sap coming out of the cut.
So don't prune in spring, yep.
Right. It depends on what you're pruning. The worst thing about pruning in winter is a thing called silverleaf. Now, silverleaf will affect roses and stone fruit. Now, in the winter is the ideal time to prune because it's dormant, etc. But you must pick a day when it's nice and sunny and the ground is on the dry side, not cool and moist or humid, if it's not so much humid in the wintertime. But that's when the disease will enter into the cuts and so forth. Now, here's another important part too. Say you've got a disease plant, tree, rose, or whatever, and you've got your secateurs and your lobbers, right? And you go chip, 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 and you fix that. And then you go to a healthy one. You are now transporting the disease from the disease one to the healthy one on your secateurs, right? Ooh. Now, there's no way you're going to put a condom on your secateurs.
Jeepers. Where'd that come from, Wally?
I just thought of that. It's protection.
You could
protection.
Rubber gloves. Rubber gloves.
So what do you do? My suggestion, which I wrote about recently, is potassium permanganate, Condy's crystals, right, which we sell, is you make up a solution of that, say about a tablespoon into a litre or so of water in a nice container, and in between each plant, rose, tree or whatever, you put your secateur blades or your lopper blades into that, or your saw, and you just give it a swirl around. It's an oxidizing agent. It'll kill any disease spores. So then you can go to the next tree or plant and good to go.
You mentioned the disease if you're doing when it's wet. What was it? Silverfish?
Silverleaf.
Oh, silverleaf.
Yeah, silverleaf.
That's a fungus, is it?
Well, it's a disease which in days gone by, it killed trees or roses. In the spring, when the leaves come out, they go silvery. And it's not because of insects. It's the disease itself that makes the leaves. And sometimes on a stone fruit tree, you'll see a branch that's got silvery leaves. The rest are green. In days gone by, and we still say this, you should remove that branch because it will spread back into the tree.
Yep.
We have a product called Perfection, which if you use that for about 6 months, once a month, if the tree or the rose has not got too bad, it will actually cure the disease and bring it back to good as gold. Some places like Blenheim, around that area, silverleaf is very bad and very...
And how do you apply Perfection?
Oh, it's a spray.
Spray. Yeah.
And okay. You spray it on the foliage.
All of it or just the infected part?
No, the whole tree. It's very systemic. It's actually good this time of the year too, because in the wintertime you're getting a fair bit of rain, and plants, particularly like citrus, etc., who don't like wet feet, too much water around the root zone for too long a period of time, the roots rot, the tree dies, right? Perfection is used for wet weather diseases like Phytophthora, botrytis, etc. And you spray it over the foliage of your citrus tree. There's no point in doing deciduous trees, which have got no leaves per se. And that will help keep them healthy and help re-establish roots and so forth if they have got a bit to the rotting side. Another thing too, which is very important this time of the year, in the cold weather and the wet, is that people have, in the summertime, put mulches around their gardens or under their citrus tree or wherever to conserve moisture, which is really great. But when it comes to wet times, then the moisture can't escape. And so all mulches should be removed going into winter to prevent waterlogging in the soil and let the soil breathe. and then you can put them back on again come later in the spring for the summertime to conserve moisture. So most important, I have untold people contact me and say, oh, my such and such has died, you know, and I'd say, oh, yeah. And there's a mulch underneath it. Oh, yes, there's a mulch. Yes, well, that you killed it. You killed it for sure.
Oh, you're a heartless man. You've got to put it, put it soft, more softly than that, surely.
I sometimes do. I say, it's gone to heaven.
Now, I had thought that in the soil, nice, rich, organic soil that's been manured over the years and made wonderful by plants, filled of happy microorganisms, unlocking symbiotically all the nutrients for the plants, and everything's happy. But things can go wrong in the soil.
Yep. The things that go wrong in the soil, historically, if we go back to 80-odd years ago, before superphosphate was invented or came along, things grew pretty well in the soil and were happy and plenty of microbes and so forth. Superphosphate is natural reactive rock phosphate, which is not available to plants per se because it takes time for it to break down naturally. So to break it down quickly, they use acid, and the acid breaks it down, makes it available to plants, but the acid is bad for the soil life because soil life, like a lovely, sweet, alkaline soil, right? So the first problem is when you start using man-made fertilizers, nitrophosphate blue, general purpose fertilizer, citrus fertilizer, etc., you've got this acid aspect in them, right?
Oh, my goodness. And so this acid is included with the rock phosphate to break the phosphate down and make it available for the plant, but it turns the soil acidic.
Yeah, it kills the soil life and kills the worms. Or the worms take five. Usually that they go, oh, my God, this is not a good environment, and off they go to somewhere where it's nicer to be.
Greener pastures.
This is why we use, particularly in the veggie garden, growing brassicas and so forth, we use garden lime to make the soil even sweeter. And New Zealand soils, naturally, because of our rainfall, are on the acidic side. Now, native plants are used to it, so they're happy as Larry, right? And then you've got the acid-loving plants like azaleas, rhododendrons. You really actually make the soil a bit more acidic for them to be happy. But for most other things, you're looking to have a sweet soil. And for the soil life, they definitely want it to be alkaline, right?
And when you say soil is made sweet, that means making it less acid, more alkaline.
Yep.
And lime makes it alkaline.
A garden lime, yes. Yep, it does. It depends on the type of lime too. Now, here we have an aspect. First of all, you've got lime from limestone. And even when it's been powdered down very finely, it's coarse. And the test is, if you get a bag of lime, you reach your finger in your thumb and you get some in between and you rub it. Now, if it's gritty like sand, that's a coarse limestone lime. If it turns to a slurry in your fingers, it's a lovely soft lime, which is quick acting, which is like seashells broken up finely. They will be soft like that. Or serpentine lime will be soft, right? A low acting lime. In the old days, we used to say, you limed your garden, veggie garden, every 10 years, and it took 10 years for the lime to break down because of the coarse limestone lime. But because you're doing it every year, it was always another year coming up where it would be active and available to the plants. killing the soil life using man-made fertilizers, using chlorinated water, which is one of the worst things you can do in your garden, is to turn the chlorinated hose tap water and water your garden. It just obliterates, which is what it's supposed to do, kill the bacteria in your water so you don't get a tummy bug. Simple way to solve that problem is you put a filter, housing filter on your outside tap. It removes the chlorine and you water your garden, which is just about as good as rainwater. Not quite, but just about. So you will, if you're using tap water with chlorine in it, you will never have a good garden. You'll always have problems. And the plants will always be not so good.
And isn't that an amazing insight? Because I would guarantee to you that 99% of gardens are being watered with chlorinated water, because I wouldn't know.
No. I can prove it very simply. You have a nice wet spring, right? And everything in the garden comes away and everything's lovely and healthy and looking brilliant, right? And then it starts to dry out a bit. Out comes the hose. Out comes the chlorinated water. You start watering your garden and suddenly everything turns to custard. Literally, black spot, rust and so forth. Plants don't look happy, etc. And then you get a week of rain and everything comes back to life again. What's happening is the microbes in the soil, the beneficial microbes, they can have, I think it's three or four generations in 24 hours. So they can reestablish very quickly. And given the right circumstances, they will reestablish. And then they are breaking down the food, et cetera, for plants to be able to take the nutrients up, et cetera, and everything's happy. And there's also the mycelium fungi in the soil. Now, we've talked about mycelium fungi in the soil.
A little.
This is a fungus that attaches itself to the roots of plants and goes out and collects moisture and nutrients and brings it back to the plant. And the plant says, thank you very much, and gives it some carbohydrates in exchange. Right. Mycelium fungi can increase the root zone of a plant by 600%.
Wow.
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 So instead of having a little root zone, say a meter wide on your plant, which is a meter tall, meter wide itself, like what's above is what's below, basically, right? So instead of that, it's going to go out several meters beyond that. And the mycelium fungi connects to other plants at the same time. You can see it in the soil sometimes when you've got a good, healthy soil and you're exposing it and you see this white streak through, right?
Wow.
Now, that is actually thousands of filaments of mycelium fungi all together, because one filament on its own, you need a very powerful microscope to see it. Right. It's also how plants communicate with each other. Did you know plants talk to each other?
I'd heard that.
Yes, they do. The easy way to show it is like if you have a stand of trees, say beech trees, a forest and so forth, and the outside trees get attacked by either insects or disease, they will communicate through the mycelium fungi to the trees further in to tell them what's happening. So those trees then start to build up the particular chemicals to help prevent the disease or the pest from affecting it unduly. And it's all done through the undernet, not the internet.
The undernet. And it's fungi.
Yeah.
Just back the car up a little bit. For the chlorinated water, you get one of your filters, which aren't expensive, and that takes care of that.
Right.
Back on this lime, do you want the fine lime or the coarse lime?
you want a soft line for quick acting.
Okay.
Ideally, because it's readily available, it's more or less instantaneous. You don't have to wait 10 years for it to be effective. Now, here's another one. This is a nice little trick in nature, right? Does your veggie garden need some lime? Question, right? So you go along, you buy one of these little special pH meters and you shove it in the ground and it gives you a reading. You go, oh, my God, it's bloody near total acid in the soil. The meters are useless. Forget them. Okay. You could get some litmus paper like you use for doing the spa pool and so forth with the little colour chart, and you could take some soil out of your garden, right, and you must have distilled water. It has to be pure. And you put that into a jar with some soil, and you shake for about an hour. And then you stick your litmus paper into the solution, take a reading, compare it to your chart, right? Now, that gives a fairly good indication, but it's a very much simpler way. You plant two small rows of peas, right? About, say, 18 inches long and about 18 inches apart or a couple of foot apart, whatever, right? One you give a dose of soft lime to, the other one you don't. And then you watch them grow. The one that's got the soft lime, if that grows better and the plants look better than the ones that didn't have it, you know you need some lime.
Well, that's good, Wally. But in the meantime, all the other plants are suffering.
Yes. The aspect, too, is that how do you get around the problem with acid-loving plants, rhododendrons and so forth, and tomatoes and potatoes? They don't want lime. If you give potatoes lime, you'll get potato scab. If you give tomatoes lime, garden lime, they won't perform very well. They want a little bit on the acidic side. So for them, you use, for potatoes, I prefer to use gypsum because that helps with root development. Gypsum is sulfur and calcium. And the sulfur neutralizes it, so it's pH neutral. For your tomatoes, you use, I'll think of the name of it, the other one.
I'll start calling you Joe
Biden. I'm having one of those Joe old Biden age moments. Yeah.
Don't worry, it'll come.
I'll skip it in a moment.
Can you overlime for the, aren't you best if you're gardening and put potatoes and your roses and your tomatoes to one side, rhododendrons to one side, aren't you best just to add a bit of lime to your garden to be on the safe side? Or can you overdo it?
Well, once again, you've got plants which prefer to be a little bit neutral or a little bit on the acidic side. So
playing with it is tricky.
Yeah. For your veggie garden, garden lime, except for potatoes and tomatoes.
Okay.
Right. For your flower garden, don't worry about it.
Right? Okay.
That's usually okay. My thoughts are, in actual fact, because the other one, which is calcium and magnesium, I wish I could think of the bloody name of it, to apply the three types to the soil, because you're applying sulfur. Sulfur is very important, right, into the soil, into the plants, because it's important for your body. Your body, as I think we've reiterated before, needs a small amount of sulfur on a daily basis. And 60, 80, 70 years ago, you would have got it through your food chain. Nowadays, of course,
Dolomite,
that's the one. Yeah, thank you,
I Googled it for you.
Yeah, you're good. And you're quick on a computer. So by putting gypsum into your garden, you're going to get sulfur there. That'll get into your veggies and you'll get your daily dose of sulfur. If you're not getting, or if you can't grow veggies yourself and use gypsum, the ideal is to take a sulfur supplement. And did I talk about this recently about how the lady, she rang me up to tell me she was ordering some MSM. MSM is sulfur from plants. It's white, not yellow, like salt from volcanoes, right? And she told me that she'd been to the optometrist, and he had said to her, look, you're starting to develop cataracts. You're going to have to get organized. You have an operation sooner or later, right? She'd heard that MSM got rid of or prevented cataracts. So she got some off us and she took it. And she went back to the optometrist about 3 months later to get a check. And he said, what have you done? She said, what do you mean? He said, the cataracts are gone that were developing. She said, really? That's good. Thank you very much. I just saved a few thousand dollars.
She also told
me that at the time in which she started taking the MSM, she had this black line, horizontal black line across the vision, and it was very annoying, and it was there all the time. As she took the MSM, that black line faded and disappeared.
Goodness me.
Now, I've heard other people too whom their eyesight has actually improved. The reason being, I think, is because MSM carries oxygen through the body to the cells and it gives a mild detox aspect to it. And as a result of that, that's why people taking MSM regularly will never, ideally, get cataracts. People that take MSM, they get relief from arthritis and other health issues. It helps in a whole lot because your body needs it, my God. And if it's not getting it through your food chain, how's it getting it? And it's important for carrying oxygen through your body. When I first started taking MSM, I was shocked. I suddenly found within a few weeks I could go into any room in the house and know why I was there. And that was scary. I even could go to the fridge and know why I went to the fridge.
We should give President Joe Biden some MSM.
Oh, he needs it badly, my God.
He does.
Yeah. So it will improve memory. And it's nature's beauty element. And women often phone me up and tell me, look, I've been taking the MSM for a couple of months now, and my hair, my nails, and my complexion have never been so good. I had a beauty consultant lady one time. She said, that's my field, is making people, you know, complexions and so forth, beauty, et cetera, et cetera. She said, I got hold of some of your bloody MSM, and she said, it works far better than all these expensive products.
Wow. What does MSM stand for?
You'd have to Google that because I can't pronounce it.
Oh, and it's what's it got in it?
It's purely organic sulfur from plants. It actually comes from pine trees, and it comes from another product called DMSO, which they distill to get the crystals, and you have a half teaspoon, thereabouts, a quarter of a teaspoon of this in the morning, night, ideally taken with vitamin C to help the absorption, definitely not taken with chlorinated water, which prevents the absorption into your body. And within usually a few weeks or a month or so, I've had a couple of people. I had one lady one time.
I'd never heard of it.
She rang me up and she told me that she was very, very suffering from arthritis to the point that in the morning it was difficult to get out of bed, right? She said, I got hold of the MSM, I started taking it, and she said, after a couple of weeks or so of taking it, I can jump out of bed now. People with twitchy legs at night, it fixes that. People sleep better, people dream better, and people... It's sulfur is an interesting thing.
It's called MSM powder, and it's, wait for it, methylsulfonylmethane.
Yeah. That's the one. I can't pronounce it. You did well.
And you can take the supplement, but we got onto this by saying we need it in our garden for our plants to get the sulfur.
Yep.
How do we get it into our plants, into our garden?
Ideally, you could probably sprinkle sulfur powder, the yellow sublime sulfur, but gypsum,
that's right.
Is the best one for it. Yeah, it's pH neutral. You can use it anywhere, particularly good for root crops because it helps root development. And whatever's in the soil, plants will take up. Do you know that in places where old gold fields were taken from the gold, right, you plant a plant or plants, proper plants in there, and hemp is a very good one for this because it's deep rooting. And then when the plants mature, you then process them and take the gold out of the plants.
No way.
That's how it works. If you've got an old house which has obviously had lead paint in the past, you would never, ever plant any food crops by the side of the house because there's lead in the soil. And that those plants, vegetables, would take it up. Particularly bad on root crops like carrots or parsnips or potatoes because the root itself stores it all in. And leaf crops, not so bad, like silver beet, cabbage and so forth, but once again, very dangerous. In fact, there's warnings in the past about having vegetable gardens next to the sides of old houses because of the lead paint aspect of the past and bad for children and their brains.
We had a lady on the show talking about lead, and it was absolutely terrifying.
Mm.
She got her house tested, and I mean, it was a hazardous waste site. Just her house had lead lights. So there's a lot to the soil, the lime, the gypsum, the dolomite, and there can also be bad bugs.
Yeah, in the pathogens. Soil. We call them pathogens. That's the microbes that are not nice fellas, and which cause root diseases and so forth and affect what's done. Now, in the old days, like in glass houses, where we grow our tomato plants in the soil, in the glass house every year and so forth, and generally speaking, if we're not using man-made fertilizers and chlorinated water, you can do that every year and not have a problem, right? But when you introduce that and kill the soil life, the beneficial soil life, then the pathogens get away. And hence, you have a number of people whom diligently each year dig out all the soil out of their glass house and take it somewhere and put some fresh soil in to overcome that problem. I think they'd be better off spending their money going to the gym if they need that much exercise, my God. So in the old days, Yates used to have a product called Bazemint, right, in which you, in the wintertime, you sprinkled that on the soil and gave it a water and you covered it over, and that went down and it killed all the pathogens in the soil, but it also killed all the soil life as well. The good and the bad were taken out. But it would give you what we call a clean start in the spring, planting your tomato plants up and so forth in there. Besmid got banned some years ago, and so we came back to the point, what do we do to sterilise the soil or to kill the pathogens in the soil without affecting the beneficial microbes and the mycelium fungi? And we have a product called Terracin. Terracin is some aggressive...
Is that with a T? Terracin.
Terracin. We apply the Terracin with non-chlorinated water, of course, to the soil as a soil drench. And then that goes down, and the simple way to explain it is the really Superman microbes in there go down and beat up on the pathogen and give them a hard time, right? And it knocks them back, right? And then a couple of weeks later, we apply another product called Microcin. Microcin actually feeds the microbes in the soil and the mycelium fungi. So that will build up the beneficial microbes in the soil. And because there's a competition for food sources between the beneficial microbes and the pathogens, the microbes are too big a population. They eat everything up, and the pathogens that are left starve to death and disappear.
Wow. So
it's a nice, natural way, and you can do it whether the plants are there in the ground or not in the ground or whatever, because it's going to be a benefit. Now, here's another one in which I've had a couple of people just recently say, oh, I've got this row, it's hedge, right? And it's such and such a plant, all uniform. But one of them's died, and now the ones on the side are dying. What's happened, of course, you've got Phytophthora, root rot, that's taken one out, and that's spreading to the others. So once again, if you plant the same species into that spot, which you've got to because you want a uniform hedge or Pittosporum, whatever they are, so you use the Terracin and the Microcin treatment to kill the pathogens in the soil, and then you can plant a new plant and maybe give another treatment subsequently of the same while it's establishing, and you're home and away.
If you've got a soil that you think is a bit sterile of microorganisms because of past practice, do you need to inoculate the soil, or does that inoculation, do the microbes just arrive naturally?
You can introduce microbes. Here's an interesting one. Microbes, mycelium fungi. Some plants are very, very difficult to establish, right? So people, I can't think of one off the top of my head, but there are some. Clematis might be one of them. The problem is, whenever you try to establish one in an area, it does okay for a little bit and then fizzes, right? What you do is you go and find a mature specimen of that same plant, and then you take some of the soil from underneath it, and you plant your plant with the mature, which has got the right microbes, right mycelium fungi, and the plant takes off and thrives and goes, no problems at all, right?
Fascinating.
So what was your question again?
Oh, it was whether you needed to inoculate it, because I've got beech trees, and I went into a beech forest and just scraped up a bit of the litter and soil and just sprinkled it over them, thinking that would inoculate them.
This is leaf litter.
Yeah, no, the soil, you know, under the litter. I got the soil. So I got beech trees, and I went into a beech forest and just got a, you know, literally a handful of the soil and sprinkled it over them to inoculate the soil.
Oh, right. Yep. And it worked.
Well, I don't know, but the trees are happy.
They're growing, yeah. Unless you did some without and did a control experiment.
Yeah, no, I'm not.
You
I didn't
you
want
don't
to do
really
this.
Know, but
I didn't do the experiment. I just did it because it was easy to do.
If you're making compost teas, if you're using animal manures, all the natural things in your garden, you will build up the microbial activity in the soil. years ago, I brought in from Australia some microbes, which were freeze-dry. Now, this is like three or four different types of trichoderma, plus a whole range of beneficials, right? And which you actually brewed up with special food in a bucket with a heater and air bubbles, right? And you made a concoction of very zillions of beneficial microbes, right? And which you could water in or spray over plants in your garden, etc. A few people took it up, but most of the people didn't. It was just something they didn't relate to. I wrote about it, and it had very few takers. It was only the real enthusiasts that could cotton on to what it was all about, right? It's difficult, too, with importing that sort of thing, that getting it through MAF, because they're very conscious of bringing in pathogens instead of goodies. It's just they're there in the garden. And if now there's a thought. You went to a place where the beech trees were and you took some soil from that. Now, if you go out to the bush, it doesn't matter where it is, where it's all natural anyway, and it hasn't had man-made fertilizers and the leaves all disappear quickly into the ground, because at leaf fall, for deciduous trees, if the soil is very healthy, it takes no time at all for those leaves to disappear without having to do anything.
And that's the bugs.
Yeah. So you've got beneficials in the soil, right? So if you were to go and just take a bit, you don't need a whole lot, and sprinkle that through your garden.
There you go.
You're away. The only problem is you might be also picking up some weed seeds at the same time, and you might get some new weeds, and as long as you don't let them seed, you can pull them out and deal to them without Roundup. And you'll be sweet as.
There they go.
Somebody accused me when I mentioned about Roundup one time about the aspect for people that still use herbicides such as Roundup, that you can make them better by adding rain guard to them and increase the kill rate by 50%. And they thought I was talking that I use Roundup, my God.
Not our Wally. But you help everyone, right? You help everyone. So if people
that rings up or contacts, emails, so forth.
How do we contact you, Wally?
0800-466-464. That's 0800-466-464. My mail order website is exactly that, www.0800-466-464. .co.nz. Simple.
I haven't quite persuaded my wife that I need a maggot farm for my hens.
That's a difficult one.
Yes. She says, so you're going to hang up some rotten meat in the hen run to attract flies so they'll lay eggs and have maggots drop under the run. I said, yeah. She says, I don't want flies and rotten meat around my place, even though it's a good distance away. So I haven't quite got there yet.
Yeah, but it's a difficult one. Yeah.
It also occurred to me that would only really go well in summer, right, when there's lots of flies.
Yeah, sure.
Now, what about your worm farm? Do you feed your worms to your chickens?
Well, the worms in your worm farm are what we call tiger worms, and they're more beneficial to be used. And why would you? Worms are beneficial in the garden. Now, okay. I know as a boy on my uncle's farm, I used to go out and lift the cow pads and grab the worms and take them and feed the chooks. And while I was on holiday there for a couple of weeks, and they had like 50 chooks, you know, the big population of chooks and so forth. You know, they got so attached to me that when I left after the holiday, they wouldn't lay for about a month.
Aren't they funny creatures? I've got to say, I've got quite attached. It's a funny thing. It's like a screaming baby. You get attached to them. I've got very attached to my hens now after being terrified of them, scared witless of them. But they have such a personality.
Mm. And they drink a lot of water. So I have about ice cream containers, you know, the 2-litre ice creams. I've got about 10 of those, which I fill up regularly. I've got a lid off of a 200-litre drum, right, which is quite a big, what's the name? I fill that up with water, and I've also got an old oven thing, which I fill up. And I tell you what, every 2 or 3 days, I'm having to go around and fill all these things up, and in summertime, every day.
Well, can I tell you, and listeners, how stupid I am? Because I went and picked up my chicken coop and chicken run on Facebook over in Wanaka. And a man had bought a new property and it had this coop and run and it's beautiful. And he didn't want it, so he sold it on Facebook and I get it all. And it came with a feeder and it came with a Appleton's, because I Googled it, drinking thing. Like a container. It's a big container with a round thing. And I thought, oh, it's great. It's got the water. So I told my daughter, you know, fill it up with water. So we were pouring the water in, and you'd get like an inch. God, we were doing it 3 or 4 times a day. And I thought, it's got that big bubble up front. There must be a logic to this, but I couldn't see it. So I Googled hen waterers. And this exact model popped up at Appleton's, which is apparently supplies hen stuff. And they said, when you fill it, you push it down on its back and you put the hose in and you get 20 litres of water in it, not a couple of 100 mils. So now that thing will give me 2 or 3 days of water. But I did feel pretty silly because I was looking at how do you get the water up inside it, like down on its back. I did feel pretty stupid. But to be fair, I didn't tell my daughter, who's, 11, that I'd Googled it. I said, I think this is how you fill with water. She said, gee, Dad, you're so clever figuring that out. dear.
Now, there's an interesting thing. I read somewhere that if you give chlorinated water to your chickens, it reduces their life to half.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, I know very well, I told you the story about chlorinated water in my Shar Pei dogs.
Yes, you did. They wouldn't touch it unless they were dying of thirst.
Yeah. And those early ones who were given before I had filtered water, they only lived to about 5-7 years and died. All of them died with kidney failure, right? Then when I went to filtered water everywhere, I had Shar Pei living up to 14 years of age.
That's amazing.
Big difference, yeah. And think what it's doing to our kidneys. Like, you've got to filter your alcohol through your kidneys as well, and that's bad.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's not enough room for
more stress with chlorinated water or fluorinated water. My God.
Well, that's Wally Richards for another session. Wally, I love chatting to you. You're very, very popular with our listeners. We'll get some questions in for next week or next time we have you on. And thank you for your help with the hens, because it's been amazing. And I'm going to look up those other products. What was that product you use? The hens? Chow something.
For the hens?
Yeah, chow, the feed, the pellets.
Oh, yeah, the one with muesli. Go to Farmlands. PGG Wrightson. PGG Wrightson is where I get mine from. Farmlands. And it's called Chicken Chow or something like that. And just ask the man. The one with the muesli. The molasses.
Not muesli, molasses.
Yeah, it is a muesli mix, but it's got molasses added to it.
Okay, got it. There you go. I went into Farmlands in Cromwell yesterday and got totally perplexed because there was one very expensive and one cheaper, and I was opting for the cheaper one. So, if they're laying eggs, you really need this one. And I'm thinking, is this a sales pitch? I don't know. And they were very sweet, but you had a sense that the sales agent had been through and explained what to do. And you're thinking, I'm a bit like you. In the old days, hens didn't get pellet food, did they?
No. And dog roll will make them lay. Give them a bit of dog roll every now and again.
The dog roll, because we keep a check, the dog roll really, really upped the game.
Yep.
And they love me.
Yep. Dog roll and chickens will be loving you.
Yes. I take the dog roll up when my daughter's at school, so the chickens particularly like me. And know that I'm a friend, not a foe, so I'm not so scared of them. There we go. You're on Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. We've been gardening with Wally Richards and raising hens. Thank you for listening. Wally, we'll talk soon.
Yep, thank you.
Are you loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it, and right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.